WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know. Wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. After Donald Trump won in 2016, stunned Democrats found ways to cope. Some marched, some donated, some screamed into their pillows. John Lovett launched a new podcast, and more than a podcast, a media empire. Now, Lovett had been in politics for a long time. He worked on John Kerry's campaign when he was just out of college, and then he went on to write speeches for Hillary Clinton, and finally, in the White House, for Barack Obama. Lovett then got together with some of his former Obama administration friends, Jon Favreau and Tommy Vietor, to launch Crooked Media. Crooked Media is an unabashedly partisan effort to counteract powerful conservative outlets like Fox. Crooked Media's flagship show is Pod Save America, which has been a huge success in a pretty crowded field. And now, two elections later, Donald Trump is once again on the ballot and ahead in a lot of polls. So I called up John Lovett to talk about what we learned last time and why America still needs saving. John, welcome, and I'm thrilled to be with you. I listen to you guys all the time, and I want to get into how Pods Save America came about and the thinking behind it, but I got to get right to the big question, the Biden campaign. Mm-hmm. The latest damage was a report about the classified documents case, and the special counsel said, okay, Joe Biden's not going to be charged with a crime, but it included the unfortunate phrase about a, quote, well-meaning elderly man with poor memory, and other pot shots at Biden's mental state. So what's going to save the campaign, John? What's going to rescue it?
Yeah, they've been. I have the answer.
I know.
So that's
why
good
I'm
here
you.
With it. Here's, yeah, look, I think unlike Joe Biden's opponent, they could not bring charges against Joe Biden after an exhaustive 15-month investigation. And because we live in hell, this is a disaster for Joe Biden. This has led to not the first, not the second, not the third. Some numbered freak out about this Joe Biden liability. And it's a freak out I have on my own. And I recommend people do it mostly on their own. frequently. Here's where my head is at. What are we going to say about this election, assuming Joe Biden and Donald Trump are both the candidates on the ballot in November of 2024?
And you do and I just do, no?
I do, you do. Mm-hmm. Let's assume that is the case. And by the way, one of the reasons I do with regard to Joe Biden in the wake of this report, even as it led to another round of what would happen if Joe Biden didn't run, is Joe Biden's political worldview is in part shaped by, I think, a valid sense that one of his jobs as the leader of the Democratic Party and the anti-Trump movement is to not confuse big and important political shifts with the vagaries of the news cycle. So there's two stories I think we will tell about this moment. One would be this anti-Trump coalition that formed in the wake of Trump's victory that has led to Democrats outperforming in 2018, 2020, 2022, 2023, that it may be dissatisfied, it may be frustrated, it may be angry, but it is fundamentally responsible. And that responsible coalition will reemerge and make sure that this country is protected by a Trump term. Now, that's one story. The other story is we will look back on this moment and say, the system was blinking red. What voters felt was obvious. They were shouting it from the rooftops. The fact that age was an unsurmountable liability. That's where we're at.
How deep runs the analogy between 2016, but her emails, and 2024, but his, I don't know, his errors, the kind of errors that all older people make?
I don't think this is as much a situation where you could say the media is unfairly drawing attention to Joe Biden's age, in part because this is not a conclusion people are reaching through a kind of like mediated, they're seeing videos and they're saying he seems old and frail. Now, I think that there's a very good argument to be made that by all accounts, behind the scenes, Joe Biden is up to the task. He is able, he is, you know, there was a report, I think today or yesterday in Axios kind of doing a play-by-play about a meeting on the border. And what you see is a person, maybe he was too angry in that meeting, but he was in command.
No, he gets pissed off with some frequency.
Yeah. But when you watch him on the stump, especially because I think getting older has exacerbated like a lifelong stutter, he was at times ornery and not exactly tactful when he was a younger man, that some of these things are exacerbated. And in Trump, in the reverse, right? He is more energetic. I think the threat of federal jail time, it sharpens the mind. But by all accounts, it's right. Emotionally, psychologically, and mentally not up to the job.
John, as somebody who's been inside campaigns, inside administrations, and now very much inside the media world, how would you rate Joe Biden's election campaign so far? What's he doing wrong? What are they doing right?
Maybe not the best podcasting, but I am in a place of just sort of, I have no fucking idea. I just feel a little bit lost in part because, so late last week, Meta announces that they are going to not show people political content in their feeds. Now, you could say, well, maybe that's good, right? Because there'll be fewer conspiracy theorists spouting political nonsense in people's feeds. But then at the same time, will that mean, you know, the feed that shares the New Yorker stories or the Times stories or Crooked Media stories are less likely by osmosis to get in front of less informed people? What I see is a media environment in which it is harder and harder to get information in front of people. Joe Biden starts this campaign, we're at the beginning of 2024. Most people on the whole do not know that he capped insulin costs, passed the CHIPS bill, passed an infrastructure bill, passed a gun bill, passed a climate bill. The vast majority of people do not know about Joe Biden's accomplishments. So when they say to a pollster that this is not someone they view as being up to the job, they're not coming at that from a basis of understanding how he performed in the job so far. What are we going to ask of the Joe Biden campaign? All right. And what does it have to do as the kind of last line of defense against this sort of fascistic, authoritarian Trump second term? And then where is it that we are asking of the campaign to take on the job of making up for a fundamentally broken information system?
I think what we're asking is that Joe Biden be a much more present, energetic explainer of his own case.
Yes. Well, I would say, here's what I think. What is the campaign going to do over the next year to make sure more people understand what he did and that people understand the choice, right? Now, there's been a lot of sort of discourse, hand-wringing, like where is that campaign? It's been slow to get started. Smart people say that's true. Other smart people disagree with it.
What do you say?
Now it is 2024. I think now's the time. I think we have the State of the Union coming up. That is an opportunity. Now,
you think Joe Biden would go on with you guys?
He has before. I think he will again. I think he should. I think over the last couple of years, what we have seen is that one of the reasons Democrats have overperformed in special elections is because there is a very engaged, politically aware coalition of nerds. And they listen, you know? And these are the people, they're already voting for Joe Biden. You know, a lot of our audience is already voting for Joe Biden. But these are the people that need to not just understand why they need to vote for Joe Biden, but feel in their bones that they understand why this is worth not just voting, but giving up their weekends, knocking on doors for, donating for, volunteering for, and feel as though they are armed with a persuasive and a story that they can share with their friends and family in a passionate way.
You talked about a broken information system. Part of that anxiety has got to be about who you're speaking to and who you can't reach.
Yeah.
Who are you reaching and who are you not reaching, and what do you do about it?
Obviously, we talk about being a polarized country, but just as important a divide is the divide between hyper-engaged people that are paying attention to politics and people who don't. The difference in how they think and talk about politics between someone who knows who John Thune is and someone who doesn't know who John Thune is extraordinary.
Right. Yeah.
And if you are engaged, what you're feeling is that kind of an onslaught of political and non-political content. You're seeing tons of news, tons of stories, tons of information. If you're not, you're encountering politics by accident much less than you used to. And I do really worry about that big group of people who aren't seeking out the news, because the ways in which the news would have come to them are slowly vanishing, right? Local papers are dying. People are cutting the cord and not watching the local news. Even their algorithms are sharing less information. And so what is more likely to reach somebody who isn't paying daily attention to politics? Who is a Democrat? What is a voice from the left they're going to see, and what is a voice from the right they're going to see? It is more likely that they're going to see Marjorie Taylor Greene or a story about Lauren Boebert giving a handy at Beetlejuice than they are about Chris Murphy and Lankford working on a bipartisan border deal. And if you're someone on the right, are you more likely to encounter by happenstance a smart column about Joe Biden and what he's achieved? Or are you more likely to see video of a college professor saying that October 7th was not just justified, but good? Right? What is politics going to seem like to you? It's going to seem ugly. It is going to seem cynical. It is going to seem pointless. That is going to reaffirm their preconceived notion about why they're not paying attention in the first place.
I think we have a pretty good idea what you and your colleagues on Pod Save America think about right-wing media. I think it's pretty clear, and it's often hilarious and entertaining. What also comes out of listening to Pod Save America is a certain wised-up skepticism about what people would call the mainstream media or liberal media, and a real, well, just very skeptical about lots of individuals and institutions that come under that umbrella. Break that down for me a little bit, and how you came to that view while being a speechwriter, while working in the White House, while working on political campaigns. That's a very particular angle of vision. What were you seeing, and why did it cause you such distress that lasts to this day?
Well, I think that there's a cynicism in political news coverage. And that basically is treating what happens in Washington the way an Attenborough treats watching animals on the Serengeti, you know, observing from afar, providing explanations and contest for other humans watching these animals battle. And what we felt when we started Cricket Media was that there was too much media that treated people like cynical observers and not enough that treated them as frustrated participants.
Well, give me an epitome of the first part. What would be, whether it's in the Times or the Post or the New Yorker or network television or cable TV, what's the epitome of the kind of thing that was driving you crazy?
When in 2009 or 10, President Obama went to the Correspondents' Dinner. And we made a series of fake headlines. And one of the headlines was something like, And they were historic, fake historical headlines. And one of them was something like,
Lincoln saves union, but can he save House majority? I don't know if you can see, there's a little portion there. He's lost the Southern white vote.
And that was a specific moment where Barack Obama is president in the midst of a financial crisis. He is presented with no good options, only bad options. He's trying to prevent a deeper panic. And I don't even remember at this point what political or legislative victory this followed. Maybe it was the Recovery Act. But there was a story that followed it that said something like, President Obama passes this bill. Where's the bounce, right? Oh, if he did something so good, why isn't it showing up in the polls? There is plenty of room for political analysis that said, did this policy work? What did people think about this? What are people's perceptions? But that has swamped coverage of the thing itself. And I'm not saying there isn't space for the icing, but there's got to be cake underneath the icing that gives people a broader sense of what's happening in the country. And so even right now, we have story after story about why people believe Joe Biden is ineffective, but very little coverage that explains to people what Joe Biden did in his first term to be effective. Now, that is the lot of the Biden campaign to overcome.
Isn't there an,
right?
isn't there an alternate interpretation of that? Is that it's provided over and over again. It's just that it doesn't penetrate the way you want it to.
100%.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I do think a lot of media criticism, I am certainly not
I mean, how many times have we had the argument about against horse race coverage?
Of course. You know what, though? Sometimes boring and hackneyed arguments are still true. we're just fucking sick of them. You know? Like, that's part of the problem. Sometimes journalism is desperate to find something new to say. Yeah. But you know what? Sometimes the truth is boring and still worth being said. All that is the case. I do sometimes think, and I think I do this, that my problem is not supply, it is demand. I think sometimes that's a broader problem. We visit on the media our criticisms that we really would rather level against people, but it feels elitist or negative or unhelpful or ugly to say, oh, people don't care, people aren't paying attention. You could tell them a million times, they wouldn't notice. And you see this, by the way, you see this in political coverage, which is, oh, people have no idea what Biden achieved. It's very rare that a story says something like, and therefore we're deeply frustrated with the American voter for not doing a better job of being informed. There's no equity in that. There's no money to be made in saying that. And so we put the criticism on the media, we put it on the campaigns.
Even the phrase sometimes used, the low information voter, reeks of a suspicious elitism.
But, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
And you remember the Trump moment where he bellowed from the podium.
We won with highly educated. We won with poorly educated. I love the poorly educated.
Information efficient voters.
What did Trump understand about the media that others did not and take advantage of it?
He understood this conversation instinctively. There's something I always think about with Donald Trump, and it was from Mad Men. There's this guy, Pete Campbell, and he's a hustler and he's ambitious and he's kind of unctuous and nobody likes him, but he works hard, he fights. And then there's this smooth talking other guy that seems to get all the gigs and he can't understand it. And finally, his boss says to him, look, Pete, you make the clients feel as if their needs are met, but Cosgrove, he makes the client feel as if they have no needs. And I've never seen a better encapsulation of the difference between Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis. Ron DeSantis is desperate to prove he meets your needs, but Donald Trump gets up there and they don't have any needs anymore. And when he says, oh, back in the day, we used to bat these people around, or, you know, these NATO countries, they're not going to get a free ride anymore. It sends a message that he's on their side no matter what, that he's going to say whatever he feels he needs to say, and that they can trust him when they don't see him. Because he's their guy. Even if they know that he doesn't mean it, even if they know that this is going too far, that it's a signal that he cares about what they think and not what anybody else thinks.
John Lovett is a former White House aide and the co-host of Pod Save America. We'll continue in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and I've been speaking today with John Lovett. Lovett is a veteran of Democratic politics and a former speechwriter for Barack Obama. He's also one of the co-hosts of the liberal podcast Pod Save America, alongside Jon Favreau, Dan Pfeiffer, and Tommy Vietor. The New York Times called them the voices in Blue America's head. He also hosts the show Love It or Leave It, which is more of a pure comedy show about politics. We'll continue our conversation now.
Jon Stewart is returning to television.
Yeah.
You are easily the funniest person on your show, and that's it, and extremely funny. What power does humor have in a political circumstance?
Yeah, so I think now what humor does more than anything else is it has the ability to pierce through, right? A very funny joke or a monologue or an argument, it can make it across the information scape better than basically anything. That if Jon Stewart does something that's truly funny, if John Oliver does something, if Colbert does something, if a random comedian does something, if a politician does something that actually is funny and makes people laugh in a way that makes an argument, that can go everywhere.
Can Joe Biden pull off funny?
You know, he had a funny moment with Steve Doocy, right? Steve Doocy said, "You have a problem with your memory?" And it's like, "Yeah, it's so bad I called on you." That was pretty funny. That was pretty funny. Do I think Joe Biden has the timing that Barack Obama had when he did the correspondence dinner? I do not. But I think he has his moments. I think he has his moments.
How is it possible that after his losing in 2020, after January 6th, after the dozens and dozens of indictments and so on, he's not leading the race in the Republican Party? He's crushed it in a way as if he were an incumbent sitting in the Oval Office.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth going back to what Republicans were saying just after the insurrection. There was this fleeting moment where it seemed as though Republicans en masse were going to do what they were afraid to do before, which is all come together and say, we have to move on.
John, that lasted less than a night.
I know. And what a night. And what a night. Mitch McConnell's out there. They're all
Lindsey
out
Graham.
There, one after another. Yeah. Oh my, it was happening. And then, you know, it was the end of the movie and all they had to do was just get in their car and drive away. And we're saying, drive, drive, drive. You can do it. You can do it. You can do it. And they just all went back in the fucking house.
And what happened? Why? Because their voters are telling them. Their polls are telling them. Their constituencies are telling them what to do, no?
That's certainly a big part of it. It's also one thing that people have said. Yes, people are politically very afraid of turning on the base or drawing the evil eye from Donald Trump. But there were also people that said, you know what? My voice isn't going to change anything. And if I get out there and say that Donald Trump is unfit, if I tell the truth about Donald Trump, they're going to dox my family. They're going to come to my house. Political violence is already warping our politics. We've seen this over and over again. Republicans tell us that they are worried about what this base would do. Mitt Romney has security.
It's not just about keeping their jobs. It's not about,
no,
if I lose my job as a middling representative, I go home and I've got some dull job doing whatever.
No, yes, I do think that the worry that people will come after them is real. And then beyond that, it is a little bit a lack of political imagination, right? This is what the polls say. Therefore, I can't change it, right? But real leaders understand that their job at times is to reflect back what their supporters are telling them. But at times it is to have built enough of a relationship with that group of people to change their minds or to push them, right? But none of these people had the imagination to believe it was possible or that they could be successful in making that happen. And you know what? They might be right because they're all a bunch of weenies. So, you know, I don't know.
Well, you had an interview with a member of that tribe. You had an interview with Chris Christie.
Yeah.
It was kind of hilarious. And look, this is a guy who was totally inside with Trump, mm-hmm, and wanted to be even more inside if he could have gotten there. And then he turned, suddenly had a fit of conscience.
So as a practical matter, too, I'm not using this as a way to get out of answering, but I'm just saying,
yeah,
also, as I make this decision, I may decide come election day in November that it's more important for me to make a statement about how broken the two-party system is and how bad these two candidates are by voting for a Joe Manchin, for instance, because it won't matter in my state anyway for the practical reason you just talked about. It's not a popular vote system. It's an electoral system, right?
Yeah, well, obviously your vote in New Jersey, it's a moral victory, but your vote matters insofar as that this moment requires me to do something I don't find particularly tasteful, but is necessary to save the country.
And I'm not telling you that I won't. I'm just telling you I'm not there yet. You know, I mean, the only thing that I have decided firmly is that I will not vote for Trump under any circumstances.
How do you analyze a political creature like Chris Christie? Do you give do you give him credit?
Absolutely.
You do?
I do give him credit. I do give him credit. And like, I have serious disagreements with Chris Christie, and I pushed him on a lot of this stuff. I don't think we should just say, oh, because you abandoned Trump, therefore we forget what you did before.
Right.
Same thing goes for Liz Cheney. But when people show political courage in the direction we have been urging them to show it, we of course ought to give them credit. He, in his speech that he gave when he dropped out of the race, I thought he was more open and vulnerable about his feelings of having gone along with Donald Trump than he was even in the conversation I got to have with him. The way he talked about it sticks with you. You know, these decisions, they don't go away. They follow you, right? Very clear he carried that for a long time, that he made the wrong decision. But, you know, then he's on Meet the Press saying that right now he couldn't see himself voting for Joe Biden. And then I say, well, hold on a second. You just went through this whole exercise where you clearly understand.
So maybe you gave him too much credit.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
You went through this whole exercise where you barnstormed across New Hampshire and the country talking about the threat Donald Trump poses. And it is clear by your behavior that you believe and are more worried. You believe Donald Trump is a grave threat and are far more worried about Donald Trump than you are about Joe Biden. And yet you can't bring yourself now to say that you would vote for Joe Biden over Donald Trump because of your legitimate criticisms. But this is going to be the choice. And I do hope that if that is the choice, he will say that he would vote for Joe Biden, even though right now he says he couldn't.
I can't tell from listening to you guys all the time what you're going to predict after you turn the microphones off and you leave the room. In other words, how worried are you about November and where do you think this is headed?
Look, I would say off mic the same thing I'll say on mic. I have no idea. The goal, right, the job of Democrats over the next year is to make Donald Trump's liabilities insurmountable and Joe Biden's liabilities surmountable. These are the candidates that faced off 4 years ago, and it was extremely close. They both go into 2024 with more liabilities than they had in 2020.
Both.
So,
yeah,
both. Now, will it be close? I don't know. Let's assume it is, because if it's not, then that doesn't really matter that much what we do. But let's assume it's going to be very close. What can we do to help Joe Biden overcome his liabilities and make sure that Donald Trump's liabilities are salient in their minds? Now, one of the challenges is that the criticism that Joe Biden is kind of older and ineffective, right? They're confronted with that in the present. Donald Trump's threat is perspective, right? It is what he will do to democracy. It is what he will do to NATO, right? And so how do we make that feel real for people? How do we remind people of just how chaotic and dangerous Donald Trump when he was president and make sure they understand how much worse it would be in a second term? So that is the challenge. How does that play out? I wish I felt better about it. I wish I felt better about it. But anyone who tells you they know one way or the other, I think is full of shit.
And what's your role in it? What's Pod Save America's role in it?
I think our job is, one, to talk about what is happening in a way that is honest and direct and practical. And to me, what that looks like is not avoiding or being afraid of this very conversation, while at the same time reminding people that politics isn't really about how we feel. It's not about polling, and it's really not even about Joe Biden and Donald Trump. It's about what we have agency to do in this process and what we don't. And so that leads to the second part of what we have to do, which is activate a ton of people to do as much as they can, not just on the presidential, but in the Senate races, in the House races. There are abortion ballot initiatives in places like Florida. There are a ton of very important attorney general's races and other races that will determine who is in charge of our democracy, who's in charge of our electoral system. You have a Secretary of State candidate who just sent a bunch of gay books on fire. I'd like to pull her aside and say, hey, can you just tell me other examples of where the person setting books on fire is the hero? Just tell me one example. When is a person setting the books on fire the hero in the story? Mm-hmm. Is this the first time? But that's our job. And one thing that I take away from 2016 that I'm trying to remind myself all the time now is, I mean, if you're hearing this, if you're listening to Pod Save America, if you're reading the news daily, you are ahead of the game. You're paying attention. You understand the stakes in this election. And therefore, how you feel kind of doesn't really matter that much, or at least it shouldn't. Your job is to know, despite how you feel day to day, how worried you are, how hopeful you are, put that aside. Your job is to remind people who aren't paying as close attention, who may be angry, frustrated, complacent, what have you, about what they can do, right? Your feelings, put them aside. How can you help somebody who may have similar feelings or who may not be paying attention at all to make sure they understand their power? Because you already understand yours. and to remind people that our concerns and anxieties that we feel in the run-up to November will be nothing compared to how we feel the day after the election is over.
John, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
John Lovett is one of the hosts of Pod Save America, which they describe as a political podcast for people who aren't ready to give up or go insane. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target and destroy cancer-causing proteins right inside the cell. It's how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. While it's accurate to call Brontës Pernell a novelist, his books, and there are many of them, are just one slice of what he does as an artist. Pernell has made films and he's written for TV shows like Queer as Folk. He plays in bands, and his first solo album, in an electronic vein, was called No Jack Swing.
I was just kind of wondering what it means when you say
ghosting is a clear form of communication.
Like, what do you mean by that?
All of that work reflects the underground spirit of the Oakland, California punk scene in the early 2000s, where Brontës Pernell came of age. Pernell's new book is a memoir with the unbeatable title, 10 Bridges I've Burnt. He spoke with Jeffrey Masters, who's a senior producer on the Radio Hour.
You know, when I pick up a Brontës Pernell book, I always know that there are going to be scenes, specifically sex scenes, that make me gasp and blush, that make me cringe and always laugh. And that is definitely true with this new book. It's a memoir in verse, but it skips over these traditional memoir beats. These capital L life events that we often see, they're not a nat, and they're presented when necessary, but it's these smaller moments of his life that stand out. And it's these smaller moments, or seemingly smaller moments, we should say, like getting into a fight at a poetry conference, or as he describes it, the humiliation of jogging. It's those things that Brontes gives the most weight to, and just one of the many reasons why I wanted to talk to him about this new book.
Okay.
Should we jump in and do it?
Let's do it.
One of the things that I find so compelling about your work, both in this book and your last book that was called 100 Boyfriends, and one of the things I'm so interested by is how much you honor a deep platonic love, right? It's almost like a platonic romance in many ways among your friends. And I wonder to start if we can have you read a section in the book that deals with that. I was thinking page 49.
Okay. He is my father and my newborn. I take the greatest of care with him. When I rub the sleep from his eyes, rub his shoulders, pull the boogers from his nostrils, wipe the shimmer from his starry eyelids. Before we go back to the party, it is not hard to see what they see when we are together, the way our eyes soften in each other's direction, hints at the silent song we sing to each other, the vowels so clear they are invisible, sometimes even to us.
Yeah, thank you. I love that because, you know, we as a society, we uplift romantic love only, right? That's the thing to aspire to the most. But here you are writing a love poem to a friend.
Oh, yeah, I know.
And not just a friend, we should say. The poem's name is called For Jackson Howard, and that is your editor of your book.
Yes. Me and Jackson, it is giving manic pixie 40-year-old and manic pixie twink energy. Is like, literally, I remember, like, it was like he hit me up about a book deal, and then like a week later he was like, hey, come to New York, come sleep on my couch. Yeah, we talk every day. Like,
and so is he the reason why you're now with your publisher FSG?
Yeah, totally.
I asked that because, you know, when I first discovered your work years ago, you were this, like, you know, more underground writer. You had a cult following, but it wasn't independently published, but it was like much smaller houses. And now that you're with like a major publishing company, do you think that's like changed your writing at all?
I think a little bit, but also too, it's like I was already. The trajectory of my writing was already happening because, I don't know, I meet so many, like, people who, like, and they ask me these questions about writing, and I feel like they want their first manuscript to, like, win a Pulitzer off the bat. Like, they want to hit a home run their first try. And, like, I tell them, I was like, I've been writing for free for, like, 20 years, you know? But, you know, what I think that was great about being on Underground Publishers is that I really got to do what I want. I had the luxury to, like, improv and experiment. And, like, to be honest, like, that is gold. It's just a great way to develop your style. And quite honestly, like, my first book, Johnny, Would You Love Me If My Dick Were Bigger? Like, around the time that was written, I think that was finished. I started writing that in, like, 2009. And then it wasn't finished to 2012. There was no publisher in the world that would have put that book out. There was no major publisher in the world. But my love was writing. And so I kept writing and I kept refining. And then, I don't know, I think that's why 100 Boyfriends, as wistful as it seems to some people, 100 Boyfriends was the work of a lot of dedication, a lot of time, and a lot of devotion to kind of like style and an aesthetic that had been built up, you know, 5 zines and 3 books before it ever saw, you know, light on the earth, you know. I think the longer a writer gets to kind of spiral in their own kind of chaos, you know, I think I akin it to like building the roux, making the roux deep and rich. Like, that's what you spring out of.
So tell me this. For the new book, it's a memoir in verse. This is not a traditional type of book that we often associate with memoirs. Like, what does memoir mean here for you?
Oh, memoir is, for me, is complete fiction. To be honest, let me be very honest with you. I'm always playing with the idea and the trope that in order for, like, women, gay men of color, or people of color in general, in order for our work to be accepted as truth, there has to be the word memoir on it, you know? And I've gone over this debate lots of times about how in our society, the only people smart enough to write fiction is like white men, right? And so the second you write memoir, it's like, wow, this gritty tale of this abandoned homosexual spilling his entire guts to the world. Wow, let's use his life against him. When in actuality, even when I write memoir, I can't, like, in order not to get sued, you have to change everything. Memoir is fiction. I don't care what anyone says. Like, you and I both could write down our lives as true as we know it. But the second our mom reads it, or one of our siblings reads it, or anybody else peripherally in the book, they can easily say, what are you talking about? That never happened like that. And it renders everything we say like kind of fiction. So I am, when I say memoir and verse, I am kind of trickily dealing with the very sticky notion of memoir.
Right. And so are you saying that like full stories are fabricated, or like certain details are embellished, or like both?
Well, both and neither. But also, too, it's like, even when if you write about your life, you have to protect the wicked, too, namely yourself. So there is this game of pulling and punching. And even in my regular autofiction life, the other books that they call autofiction, there are like things that are totally a pack of lies mixed with things that are absolutely true. And at the end of the day, like, it doesn't really matter, because I think that it's very foolish to believe that a fictional story has nothing to teach you about the human experience, or that memoir has exponentially more to teach you about the human experience than fiction.
I mean, I think that one example of this not being a like a traditional memoir, as we've been talking about, is that only in passing do you mention HIV. You're listing something and you say, quote, the boy who gave me HIV, and then it's never mentioned again. And that stands out because there have been like entire memoirs devoted to the subject.
I am from that weird generation where PrEP happened like 5 minutes after I serial converted, literally. Like, if I had been one generation younger, it wouldn't have been anything. And also, I think that subject has been written about very well and very extensively. And so I don't know. I think I wrote about it in Johnny, Would You Love Me If My Dick Were Bigger. I don't know if you can say that. My first book about kind of like the malaise of, you know, our generation. And, you know, I had older men talk about like how they felt sorry for us because we knew what AIDS was before we knew what sex was. And so that was a way different thing than just knowing what sex was, and then came AIDS. And so sometimes when we talk about the disease, when we as gay men, you know, talk about the disease, the conversation always goes to like the generation of gay men we lost, which is like horrific or whatever. But we never talk about like who it is affecting now, which something about that I feel is disingenuous. Like, we should be having a smarter conversation about how it shifted and how we could help those people. It becomes kind of how like those like pro-life people love talking about, you know, the unborn, because essentially the unborn is a group of people that's easy to advocate for because they require nothing of us. Giving lip service to the scores of men that died of HIV is easy because the dead require nothing of us.
Right.
What are you doing for the men that actually survived and lived? Like, what are you doing for them? The answer is usually nothing.
Well, tell me this, like, sex is one of the things that I think you are known for in your writing. In this book, in your last book, 100 Boyfriends, what have you learned about how to make sex work on the page?
I say that I write anti-erotica. Because I don't
okay,
know.
What does that mean?
Like, I remember, you know, in my when I was 18 and 20, like reading these different sex journals by these like gay men, and I get why they wrote that way. They were just like, my body was like a porcelain statue as I received his da 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 da. Right, the sex writing that I saw was very aggrandizing of sex, very aggrandizing of. You know, nothing was flawed or out of place, but it is because men were writing like that because of the AIDS epidemic, whereas I write about sex in a way that's supposed to return our humanity to us, you know, where sex is gross, sex is wrong sometimes, sex is extremely funny sometimes, you know, and sometimes it's like nice or sweet or, and plus I like worked at the bathhouse in my 20s. I had this experience that I think a lot of men didn't have. I think every gay man should be required to work at a bathhouse. If you just go sit in a bathhouse when you're young, you know, when your synapses are still open and you're still willing to try some stuff, it will completely change your sexual life forever. It will not make you fear aging. You know what I'm saying? Like, you will be ready to have, like, a lot more fun, I think.
Okay, wait, though. You kind of talk about that in the book, but from the opposite angle. You're writing about your 20s and your 30s, mm-hmm. and you say you were trying to be sexy, to appear sexy to others, but now you have found, quote, the courage to be ugly, old, and defiantly unwantable. So, like, connect that for me, because you're talking about, you know, not fearing aging and stuff, but also now you write about being, like, unwantable, as you say.
What I mean to say is, I spent, I think, a good 20 years doing that. I think wisdom comes from having too much just so you know what just enough is. And so I feel like in a way I have answered almost all the questions I personally have had around the subject of sex. It doesn't quite hold the same fascination for me like it used to.
There's more sex in this book than like romantic relationships, you know, romance. Looking back on your life, is it the sex that stands out the most to you?
You know, I don't think it's hard to say, because it's like, you know, there were men that I had sex with for upwards to like 10, 15 years that I met at the bathhouse.
Wow.
You know, where I never even knew their last name. And these were men of like, you know, like they were pretty instrumental to like my formative sexual years. You know, what constitutes an intimate relationship is so, I have a hard time piecing that out, what that means in all of our different worlds. At some point after you've been doing this dance with someone for 4 or 5 years, I do feel like that's a relationship, and I do feel like it's intimate, and I do feel like it's important, more so than anybody I ever pretended to play boyfriend with, you know, so.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned that you're also a musician. You've been a part of many bands. You also released your first solo album last year.
Do not say that you will pray about this way I'm feeling. You count your ducks while pretty voices cry themselves to sleep at night.
What does new, like, making music do for you or allow you to express that your writing does not?
You know, there's just something about singing a melody in your head. Like, I grew up singing in the church choir, and, you know, music is the thing that I've always given the most to, that has returned the least to me, you know? I was a go-go boy in this band, and sometimes I think it's really funny, because it's like, I feel like that was the most, like, support or whatever, or that was the most money I ever made. You know, when I'm dancing in my underwear on stage for people, there's plenty of money and support for that. But let me pick up a guitar and have my own ideas. That's when the world is just like, oh, well, we'll give you $150 to record. You know, I recorded my first record with my first solo band for like $150. I remember that. But also, I don't know. there's music is definitely a calling, and it's a great time stamp. Like the songs I write, I feel like every year I get better and better at doing it. And plus, I don't know, being able to work in that realm, I think helps me in writing too. So
helps you how?
I feel like in regular writing, like it's just, you know, the written word is so, it's so staunch. It's like you have to be so stark. You have to be so on time. I feel like, I don't know, I feel like when you sing a melody, you can play with things and you can be a cheesy poet if there's a melody behind it, because it's a whole different thing. Like, I would never in my everyday poet life be like, I need flowers in the springtime. But once you're behind an acoustic guitar, you can be like, I need flowers in the springtime. And you're like, oh, I can get away with saying that because there's a guitar here now. Like, it's a weird magic. I can't explain it.
Brontez, thank you so much for talking. This was wonderful.
Anytime. I had a great time.
Oh, bless me, mother, bring my love to me tonight, and I'll endlessly toss and turn before I kill the lights inside.
That's Jeffrey Masters of the New Yorker Radio Hour speaking with Brontez Purnell. His new memoir is called 10 Bridges I've Burnt. I'm David Remnick, and that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Adam Howard, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, and Louis Mitchell, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Michael May, David Gable, and Alejandra Deckett. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.